Hello. A new book is out now called Space Journal, The Art and Science of Cosmic Exploration. A fantastic title. The author, Dallas Campbell, is my guest on the latest episode of the Podcast of Steel. And we talked all about this fantastic book, about space travel, about NASA, about Artemis II. It was a fascinating chat to learn more about space. Dallas is so passionate, has so much knowledge, and I can't wait to read this book to find out what is inside. Dallas Campbell, welcome to the Podcast of Steel. I've been excited for this conversation to talk about you, your life, and space, and Artemis II, and just everything in between. You've had Great. Such an interesting life. So if you can, if we can create an origin story for you, as it were, to explain yourself to the watchers and listeners if they don't know already.
Well, origin story. Okay, well, I'm 5'10". I've got brown hair. I've blue. I'm very old. That's the first thing your listeners might... So I'm in my mid-50s. Am I in mid-50s? Yeah, mid-50s. I started my career way back in the early 90s, I suppose. And I studied drama and I became an actor, and I worked as an actor in London for a good few years doing interesting and less interesting things. And then I made I suppose in the end of the 90s, I made a bit of a sideways journey into the world of factual television. And I ended up making science and engineering documentaries. I started off in America, actually. I worked in America. I did a program for the Discovery Channel, and then I came back to the UK and ended up working for the BBC Science Units, of which I'm sure your listeners will watch lots of BBC Science output, from Attenborough to Cox to whoever. So I worked there, and I did programmes like Bango's The Theory, which was a kind of Tomorrow's World-ish kind of early evening science show, plus lots of kind of big documentaries for BBC One, BBC Two, worked on Horizon, all those sorts of... And I covered because I'm not a scientist, I covered the kind of the interesting story beats, as it were. I wasn't just kind of channeled down, you'll do genetics and biology. I got to cover a little bit of everything, which was great. But mainly, I suppose, mainly space, mainly engineering, mainly energy infrastructure, that kind of stuff was my... The human planet, I suppose, was my area. And I write books.
You do, which we will get to as well. It's got an absolute whopper of a title. It grabs you.
Space Journal. Not my title. But still, though. I didn't invent the title.
Did you not? But it's a great... Well, the art. It's cosmic exploration.
You like
I just
it?
Love that. I love that. Okay. It's fantastic.
Good, because I wasn't sure. Because here's the thing. You kind of write the book and it's your child. And it's like someone else gets to name your child. You know, your publisher, who I love, by the way, Thames and Hudson. Amazing.
Well
so
done.
So anyway, we had some gentle sparring over the title, because I had my own title. I can't remember what they were now, but anyway, so they named it, and I think their title was obviously better than mine. And so thank you for
it. Works it. Works now. Okay, I mean, I wish we could have hours to talk about it. As we said before we start recording, I've got this book coming this week, so I didn't want too many spoilers, but I was very kindly sent a review PDF to get lost
in.
It's not as you said, it's not the same, but I could sense the magic in the details of it, and the thought and clear like passion for this that you have, because your wording for sort of even just mentioning the clangers, you've got a passion for space and science, but explaining it in a way that's fun as well.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I love good writing, you know, in the same way that I like good movies or anything else. You know, writing very often is just a bit utilitarian. It's like, I'm going to write something to give information across. And I kind of, I suppose because I'm ancient, I grew up reading great writers, and I just love a well-constructed sentence. And I like writing that takes you places, and I just like good writing. So I've always, Ernest Hemingway famously said, writing is easy. You just sit in front of a typewriter and bleed. And I understand that. I get it. It's hard. I mean, nowadays, I suppose you could just AI it. No AI was used.
No AI. Good. I mean, it's sad that we have to say that now.
Well, okay. I do tell a lie. I've been using AI recently, not to kind of help me write, but just as a bit of a sounding board. It's like, how could I structure this story, or what would be a good title for those sorts of things, those sorts of...
And assist,
not actually,
as
the kind
were.
Of writing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, so thank you for saying that, because the book is, first of all, when you get it, it's a very visual book. So there's lots of people, lots of pictures. So the first thing people say is, wow, it looks great, hopefully. It looks beautiful. But hopefully the words aren't there just as a kind of an afterthought. They're there as part of the thing.
We shall get to the illustrations in a moment, but where did the idea for this book come from?
I want to say it was my idea, but it wasn't my idea. Thames and Hudson very kindly approached me and said, look, we want to do... They've done a few history books along this line, which I suppose is a little bit like a kind of an archaeological dig. It's looking at the material culture of space exploration. So the people's notebooks, backs of envelopes, scribbles, old journals, all that kind of stuff. That marginalia, I think they call it. And the stuff to the left of the margins of the people that I write about. And they've done that with a couple of other titles. They did one about Egyptology with Chris Norton, who wrote that. And they'd done one about sea voyages. Anyway, they came to me and said, we'd like to do a space one. And I'm like, okay, how can you see this working? And they're like, we're going to leave it entirely up to you.
Wow.
So they just gave me a complete blank canvas to write about whatever I want. So I just, which is hard, honestly. There's nothing more terrifying than a blank canvas. But anyway, I sort of came up with a structure and people I wanted to talk about and ideas I wanted to talk about. And they were like, fine. There was a few that didn't make it in, which were generally because things are too expensive.
Yes.
I wanted to do a chapter about Richard Avedon and Ruth Ansell, who worked at Harper's Bazaar. And they did a very famous episode of Harper's Bazaar with Gene Shrimpton and Paul McCartney wearing the Project Mercury silver spacesuits. And anyway, it's a kind of iconic photo shoot. I thought, oh, I wanted to tell that story, but we couldn't for reasons.
Yes, for reasons. But yeah.
And there's other ones as well. Actually, the Russia situation was difficult because obviously a lot of space history, we go back to the Soviet Union and actually we can't work with the museums and various institutions in Russia at the moment for obvious reasons. So that was disappointing. So there's lots of things that didn't make it to the book. But actually what we've got, I think, is a pretty good facsimile of the original essence of the idea, which is to really explore space exploration as a wide part of human culture, not just science and engineering.
No, it covers so much. And as I said, I was getting lost in just a lot of it. And I can't wait to see the actual copy and how these images come across on the page. Because I think there's over 500 images and illustrations. And it's like, look, the man's come prepared.
I'm holding up a copy, but it is it's a weighty tome, but it is beautifully put together. I mean, the art design at Thames and Hudson is just extraordinary. They spent, you know, it's really beautiful. It's a beautiful object. So hopefully you'll enjoy reading it and looking at it. And hopefully you'll enjoy just having it in your hands and having it in your bookshelf.
There's something about big books that grab you. And I love that. Yeah. And they're great for sharing and reading together. So I'm hoping this book ends up in libraries and classrooms and everywhere around the world for people that want to know more about space and for those that don't know anything at all. It's a great stepping tool for them.
Yeah. Well, that said, so much is going on in space at the moment. We're going through this new space revolution. And I'd like to think that this book and books like it give that a little bit of context, a little bit of an origin story. For example, you're wearing a T-shirt. It's a NASA T-shirt. I know it's not a
NASA
T-shirt.
It's close. It's Nessie.
It's Nessie, but it's got the kind of sort of a play on the NASA logo.
Yes.
That NASA logo has an extraordinary story where it all comes from. So I've got a chapter about NASA typography and the NASA logos that we're kind of familiar with, but I introduce the people and the ideas behind that and where it all came from and blah, blah, blah.
It was a fantastic deep dive. Going back to sort of the NASA buses and a NASA helicopter, I've never seen that before, where some of the vehicles that were used. It was so interesting.
But also the shift between the NASA meatball logo, which is your T-shirt,
yes,
and the NASA worm, which was the, people will know, the kind of NASA written as a kind of one line of text, and where that came from and how it was hated at the time and they wanted to get rid of it. And now it's back in fashion. How all those things... You know, visual design is a really important part of space exploration, from spacesuits to typography. It's a big part of it. We don't really think of it generally in that. We see news bulletins about such and such is happening in space, or what some people have stuck on the space station, whatever it is. And that's all we know. So space is always seen as something a little bit far off. But hopefully this will give you a bit of context.
It makes it just more accessible, I feel. For me, I tried my darndest in school to pay attention, but I was always quite a little bit shy to ask questions. But what I love about this book is it kind of gives you the answers without having to ask the questions. It's all there for you.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right, actually. It's a good point that science is tainted by school in that we tend to think of science as a subject. We don't think of art or music as a subject. You know, you go to a concert, you wouldn't come out of a gig and nobody would say to you, "Oh, you must have been really good at music at school because you're at a concert." You know, but for science, people always kind of associate it with school, which I think is a shame. You know, science is just, it's a human thing. It's a great mystery story. It's turning over pebbles to see what's underneath. It's just trying to understand nature and explore nature. That's it. There's nothing more complicated than that. I mean, the doing of science is a lot more complicated.
It's a lot more complicated.
Appreciating the essence of science isn't complicated.
I mean, I've been fortunate enough to visit a few science museums and galleries around the world, and they're always fascinating place to go. Much like a museum can just be a perfect place for a date, I feel, in some situations.
Yeah.
But with this book, you get that insight more into it, and you get just a real deep dive into the facts about all of it.
Oh, that's a nice idea. I've never thought of it like that. I think my book is a little bit like going to the museum. It has it that is. Kind of museumness to it, in a good way, I hope. Where
oh, no, a fantastic way, because it's chronological.
Objects, and there's text, and there is a bit of chronology to it. Not that strict, but there not is.
But it's there. It's a fantastic process to see where we've come from and where we are now. If a time machine ever did exist, and we had that option, who would you like to go back and show this book to first?
Crikey, that's a good question. Tell you who, so it's a book about space exploration. It's also a book about biography, so it's a book about people. And in writing it, I fell in love with lots and lots of people, because they're people whose story I've known a little bit, but not much, but I went deep. And even though my chapters are relatively short, I consumed everything. And one of the people I fell in love with was Robert Goddard, who is a well-known American. You may have heard of the Goddard, NASA Goddard Flight Center. It's a name that's bandied about in America a lot for good reason. He was a rocket scientist early 20th century, before the Second World War. And famous, of course, because he launched the very first liquid-fueled rocket. But his life was so much more than that. And he was very humble. People always equate Robert Goddard with the Wright brothers, you know, the Wright brothers first in flight, Robert Goddard first liquid-fueled rocket, blah, blah. But the Wright brothers were real showmen. You know, they sold their idea, and Robert Goddard just kind of hid away, really. He was a very humble guy, but very funny and witty and clever and cultured and interesting. And I totally just became obsessed with Robert Goddard. I read all his diaries, which are published online, and what an amazing mind he had. So I would like to go back to, I could go to a very specific date, actually, 1920. I can't remember. Famous day where, as a 17-year-old boy, he climbed his parents' cherry tree in the garden, and he was chopping the cherry tree. And he looked out across a late winter field in Massachusetts. There was a bit of snow on the ground. And he'd just been reading, as 17-year-old kids do, a serialization of War of the Worlds, which had just come out. So War of the Worlds was the thing. You know, H.G. Wells. And he reasoned, he was like, well, how would Martians get from Mars to Earth? Like, they're not going to do it by magic. Supernaturalism isn't going to. So it's an engineering problem. And he set his life from that day to solving that engineering problem. And on that day, that anniversary day, in his diaries, he would put anniversary day, tick, 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 to the chair. And I'd like to kind of, well, maybe I'd spoil it, but I'd like to, as he was coming down the ladder from the cherry tree, I'd like to hand him my book and say, look, this is what...
keep at it.
This is what you did. Not just him. It wasn't just him. You know, it's very... We like to have creation stories as like Robert Goddard invented spaceflights. Others were doing it as well, particularly in Europe, particularly in Germany and the Soviet Union. But he was sort of up there. Maybe not even as the greatest rocket scientist. Maybe he was. But just as a beautiful mind. He's someone who I have a lot of time for.
So going back to your own personal timeline then, what was your moment like coming down from the cherry tree where you thought, this space and stars, this is something that means so much to me?
It's funny actually, because, you know, when I was a kid, I was a kid in the 1980s, so I grew up with space Lego, which had just come out. So,
If you still got some, we'll look after that. Yeah, I'll tell you what.
I'll show it to the camera. It was that piece of space Lego
Wow, okay.
You know, it was the sort of moon base place. Yes. Anyway, I was sort of interested in the way that everyone's kind of, as a kid, interested in space. But it wasn't kind of an obsession. It wasn't really until I started working in factual television. And suddenly I got to meet astronauts and I got to spend time at NASA and places like that I really became interested in space. And then I became interested in the history of it, going back in time to the beginning. I just became really, really fascinated with it, and sort of it became sort of all-consuming. Not even that it was about space, more that it was about people and interesting people and creativity and ideas and how do you get from nothing to something. The idea of exploration appealed to me. So, there was something very human about it. There are sort of interesting narratives about it. If we look at sort of space exploration, it's very similar to the stories of maritime exploration in the 1600s. Look, there's a little island over there on the horizon. Let's go and check it out and see who lives there. That's kind of what it is. That's kind of what space exploration is. You know, why is The Martian so popular? Well, it's Robinson Crusoe. It's the Robinson person shipwrecked on island. That's all it is. So it's just a retelling of current narratives that stick, that are very human, and we just enjoy telling those stories. So I suppose that's what it is.
And it's filled with stories. This book has got some just fantastic facts. It's sort of down to the fantastic crew that was stitching the suits for the space missions. It's details like that puts the human into sort of science. Yeah. I love that.
I do as well. That's a great story. It's how do we make a spacesuit? What is a spacesuit? Well, we've kind of imagined them in our fantasies and in our fictions, but how do we make one for real? And actually, the story of the spacesuits, I won't go into it too much, but it's an interesting story. And it's an engineering story up to a point. And it was a guy called Wiley Post in the 1930s who was an aviator, and he wanted to break the kind of speed record. I think it was London to Paris, or there was one sort of famous record he wanted to break, but he realized that if he went really high, he could use the jet stream to carry him across. But in order to get to that height, he needed to carry his air pressure with him, because obviously the air is rarefied up there. So he got his friend who worked at B.F. Goodrich, the tire manufacturing company, to design him a kind of inflatable suit. And lo, the spacesuit was born. But then, of course, fashion and politics came into it. When we first had American astronauts, you know, the high altitude pressure suits that naval aviators were wearing were kind of olive green. And we're like, no, astronauts, it's all about Buck Rogers. And so they painted them silver to make them look cool. And nowadays, the latest spacesuits that Axiom are designing to work on the moon are designed with Prada. And, you know, the kind of visual narrative of spacesuits is very interesting, as well as the practicality. So, and the people who made them are interesting. So the whole story is a rich cultural story. It's not just an engineering story. There's lots going on there.
And that's it. And it covers so much, say, from the artwork to the logos to the science behind it all, to the politics as well. There's so much information out there that it's sometimes quite hard to feel you're bombarded with information. But what I've got from this book is it's clear.
I've made it easy for you. These are all very, you know, each one of those chapters warrants entire great volumes in themselves. So I've tried to distill them a little bit and take the essence of what I think is interesting and make them easy to read, easy to digest.
Do you have a favourite section?
Oh, let's have a look. Well, it's a good question, actually. I tell you, well, every time I pick it up and go into it, I find a new favourite section.
Wonderful.
I did a little section right at the end of the book about a woman, a scientist called Alice Gorman, who's an archaeologist, but a space archaeologist. And normally when we think of archaeology, we think of ancient Egypt or Saxon hordes under field. Alice Roberts digging for Britain or whatever. And actually, she studies the archaeology of the space age, so very recent archaeology. And she tries to look at the material culture of space and understand what it says about us. Because everything that human beings do leaves a mark, leaves a footprint. And everything we do is political, and everything that we do is indelible. And that, to me, is really interesting. So I've done a little piece about space archaeology, everything from when Skylab was deorbiting back in the 1970s, there was a kind of moral panic. People think, oh my God, it's going to fall on my head. And there was lots of kind of Skylab crash helmets being designed. And so some of the artwork around that is fun. And also things like the footprints that on the moon, for example, or the stuff that we've left on Mars. How should we think about this? Do we think about it as rubbish or treasure? Is the moon a museum or is it a quarry? How do we think about are the effect of space travel. And there's beauty in some of those images as well. In fact, let me show you. I'm going to hold it up to the camera. It was image I saw of the Mars, of the surface of Mars. And it's just a tiny piece of rubbish that doesn't look like anything. I've no idea what it is. But it's just a piece of rubbish on Mars. And it really stuck out, this pristine world. And then we've kind of left.
There's our impact.
But the footprints themselves as well.
Iconic,
on the moon,
yes.
if we think about those footprints from the Apollo missions, and you think about, you know, footprints from early hominids fossilized in rock. And here we have, and a footprint is such a weird thing because it could be washed away by the sea and it could last for moments. I mentioned Robinson Crusoe. That story changes when he sees a footprint in the sand and he realizes he's not alone. And then the footprints in the lunar surface as well, that are going to be there for hundreds of thousands of years. There's just something quite meaningful and deep and about the significance of a footprint. Anyway, so my little chapter on space archaeology is my favorite at the moment, but tomorrow it'll be something else.
And that's great, because I know flicking through these pages, I'm going to find something different each time that just grabs my attention, and I'm going to hyper-focus on that and go off and research it even more, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
What was the... It's filled with facts. So was there a fact that you didn't know that you learned more about while I was going through the book?
Oh, God, I learned... Every chapter I did, I was like, holy crap, who knew that? I didn't know that. And so off I'd go down this kind of rabbit hole of you know, facts. So I can't think, you know, you put me on the spot, so I'm not going to be able to think of something off the top of my head. But I remember quite late on in the process, my editor was like, okay, we've got enough, stop writing. And I started reading about the guy who invented Space Invaders, the video game.
Yes.
I'm like, oh my God, this is the best story about, like, where... Because a little bit like how Robert Goddard, 1910 or whenever it was obsessed by War of the Worlds, and that so was the guy who invented Space Invaders, and the little Space Invaders characters that he drew came from sea creatures and reading War of the Worlds, and so I became obsessed with his story, and so little things came along all the way. I'm like, no, stop press, I'm going to put this chapter in, and they're like, no, we're not going to have that chapter. I'm like, you're going to have the chapter, read it. And they're like, okay, it's great, we'll have it. So there was a kind of rush to publish. So lots of interesting things made. Lots of facts. Too many to kind of go into now.
No, it's again, for those that love space and those that want to know more about space, it's going to be a great educational tool. And that is something that you are an ambassador for. You're doing fantastic and heroic work by getting more people into space. It's something that sometimes we don't often think about. We just say, oh, something's happening in space, but I don't really know what's going on. Whereas you've got this fantastic way of sharing it with the world, and your passion and excitement for it is quite contagious, because we want to go along this journey with you. What's been one of the most exciting situations where you've been in whilst sharing the world of sort of space and science?
Yes, I can answer that very easily. I was lucky enough to be with Tim Peake for his launch to the International Space Station. Actually, part of that whole, having a small part of that whole Principia mission, it was known as, because it was obviously, he went into space and went to the space station, but there was a huge educational program that went with it. And so being part of that, so giving talks and talking to Tim while he was on the space station. But I'll never forget actually kind of being in Kazakhstan at the Baikonur Cosmodrome with Tim, because if you're at Baikonur, it's like going back to the 90s, like nothing has changed there. And when we think of that particular spaceport, it's where Yuri Gagarin launched from, and Laika the dog, everyone, Helen Sharman, the British astronaut, and to everyone kind of launched from there. So it has this great kind of moment, this great point in space and time. So that was really special. And actually, you know, being at a launch is an incredible thing. So yeah, that was me being part of Principia, and sort of working for the BBC as part of Principia was really, that's been my space highlight.
Okay, it's sort of, that's true ambassador mode there, where you're there at the sort of the moment where it happens. And speaking of Tim Peake, I've got his quote of the book: "A breathtaking glimpse at the margins of space history." That's not a bad quote from Mr. Peake.
Not bad, is it?
That's a very nice one to have on the top of the page.
Well, I'm thankful to Tim. He's delightful, and he's always been a great supporter. I work with Tim occasionally, and it's always great fun. It's always a great treat. If I'm like, oh, I'm doing a thing with Tim, or Tim's going to be there. He's part of being an astronaut these days is about being a great ambassador. And there is no greater ambassador for education and science and fun as well. He's a fun person to be around, so that's good.
Fantastic situations to be in. Now, talking of space travel, Artemis 2, what can we talk about there, about how excited you are for that and how impactful this could be?
Well, it's a really good question, and it's a difficult one. How excited should I be? Very, I suppose, on one level, because obviously we're going back to the moon, and we've had over 50-year hiatus since we've been to the moon. Nervous, because we've been here many times. We're going back to the moon. Oh, no, we're not. We're going back to the moon. No, we're not. And things change, and because space travel is still very political, and big space missions like going back to the moon, you're at the mercy of political cycles. And we're in a very weird political cycle at the moment with Donald Trump, so we don't know what's happening. I think we've got a really good head of NASA at the moment in Jarek Isaacman. He seems to be breathing life into it again, which is good. But space has changed just so massively over the last decade, namely because of SpaceX, because of what SpaceX has done. Basically, reinventing the rocket to make them reusable has sort of changed everything, because obviously a reusable rocket means it's cheaper to get things up into space, because in the old days with a rocket, it was a bit like getting on an airplane in London and flying to New York and then just setting fire to the airplane every trip. It's completely unsustainable. And SpaceX's whole point is, if you really want to explore the solar system, you need reusable rockets, otherwise it's prohibitively expensive. And so we're at that point now. But with Artemis, I'm still unclear as to really how it's all going to pan out, because Apollo was everything was in kind of one spacecraft. The goals were clear. We're going to get to the moon first. But with Artemis, it's a long horizon. We're not quite sure what's happening. It changes very quickly. I mean, Artemis 2, which is going to launch in April, beginning of April, it seems, touch wood. I don't know when this goes out. It may have already gone
soon, up. I hope.
So that's they're redoing an Apollo 8 style figure of eight around the moon. So they're not landing on the moon, but we still don't have the architecture in place for landing on the moon. And part of the problem with Artemis is the lack of latency in launches. I mean, once every 5 years is just not good enough. You know, we should be launching every few months if we want to really presence on the moon. So I'm obviously excited, but I want to actually get there. I want to see building bases on the moon. I want to see doing good science on the moon. I think that's what I want to see. What do you think?
It's anything to do with space. The continuing adventure of space exploration is fun and exciting, and for me, just mind-blowing. I get anxious and scared and excited for the astronauts going off on this adventure. I'm not sure how they could do it.
Well, it's funny, and I've talked to astronauts about this. When you and I think about strapping yourself to a rocket ship, and which is basically just a controlled explosion, it's like, wow. But they're so well trained. I mean, they're obviously aware of the risk, and there's obviously risk, but they're so well trained. They don't approach a rocket on the day of launch going, oh crikey, I'm a bit, because they're just, it's so rehearsed, a bit like walking onto a stage to do a play. People say, crikey, how do you know what to say? And da 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 da. Well, people have told me where to stand. And I've rehearsed it a few times. And they've said, stand there and say that line in exchange for money.
That's it. And this is now for science this time around, which is, it's more heroic. But I'm hoping, as you are, that it does happen, and more people are going to get interested in space travel for this, to go into that field of research and exploration. It's
what humans great do. Time. We like to push beyond horizons. We want to see what's out there. We want to explore further. We want to see meet the neighbors. If there's any neighbors out there, we want to see what they're all about. These are human things. People say, well, what's the purpose of life? Well, there is no purpose of life, but you get a few years. What else would you like to do other than, do some art and be nice to people and find out what's going on. That's it.
Perfectly put. Now, if you were able to be the first person to set foot on a planet anywhere that's not been accessed before, what would your first words be?
That's a good question. There's a very, I don't know if you know The Onion. Do you know The Onion?
I do know The Onion, yes.
Comedy newspaper in America. There's quite a really good one they did of Neil Armstrong's first words on the moon. And it was, holy, I'm on the moon, as his first words.
That sounds about my right.
It's a really funny sketch. Well, you can read it. It's really funny. And I always thought, oh, crikey, if I was going to land on another planet for the first time, I wouldn't have some beautifully thought out. I'd be like, holy.
Holy, this is it. I'm really here. This explosives everywhere. But yeah. I mean, and that's the thing, to be in that situation, to be that first person that does that, that's what I feel is exciting. And we are getting closer to, you know, hopefully seeing more space exploration, seeing more advances in technology and ways to make it go, I say, a little bit quicker.
I think I don't agree with Elon Musk on many things. But actually, his idea of this thing of making life multiplanetary, which he talks about a lot, this is not new. Everyone involved in space from the earliest days in the 2nd century AD has had this notion of, like, humans should kind of propagate through the solar system. And it's been a staple of science fiction forever. And I don't know, there's something naturally, a natural biology in us that makes us want to explore. So I think it's an important thing as well. You know, if we are just confined to one planet, there was a moment in the late 1960s and the early 1970s when human beings became multiplanetary. We actually crossed from one planet. We crossed the ocean of space and landed on another shore very briefly and then came back. The idea that we wouldn't want to do that again seems ridiculous.
It's
not an either-or thing. People say, well, why do we want to go to Mars and get rid of the Earth? We don't. We want to keep the Earth. And actually, people criticize Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, rightly so. But Jeff Bezos's whole ethos is, let's take all heavy industry off planet Earth. Let's get rid of, you know, if we want to solve climate change, all these things, let's get rid of it and actually have things like solar panels in space and actually use low Earth orbit and orbits and the moon and actually look after the Earth better. And we can actually do that by going into space and relocating stuff like AI data centers. Let's not use all the energy here on Earth. Let's use the abundant energy in space to do all that. Let's keep Earth clean. Let's look after it. Anyway, so
perfect.
You know,
no, perfect.
We don't really think about those things when we think about Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos. We think of billionaires, you know, spaffing billions going up onto fun rocket rides. But I think there's more to it than that.
It's a process to get there, and there's so many sort of things in between that sadly will slow us down, whether it be the politics, whether it be funding. But with expeditions like this, as you said, it's getting the future excited. It's getting more people into the world of space, which is what we need.
It's exciting. It is exciting, space travel, because it's wow. It's Buck Rogers. It's fun. It is exciting, and it's a great project. It's a great engineering project, and yeah, I think it's exciting.
Yeah, I've seen a few sort of reports from Artemis 2 and the science behind it. It looks cozy in there, that's for sure. You've got to be friends with everyone there.
Yeah, how long is the mission? Is it 2 weeks? I can't remember.
2 weeks, I believe, yes. But I mean, yeah, it's cozy.
But it's a camping trip, you know, it's no big deal. That's okay.
Putting of it. Yeah, it's just a camping trip. I love that.
It's a camping trip. You know, when you're up on the ISS for a year, then that's... You know, that's when you've got to put your blinkers on and just keep one foot in front of the other.
Strap it. Take a good book and get yourself sorted out. If we were, say, 50 years in the future and another version of this book was released, what are you hoping to see in that in the world of space exploration in 50 years' time?
Well, if I was to sort of start writing the book now and then go right about 50 years, what's coming up? Well, we're going to go back to the moon. I think we are going to go back to the moon this time. I think it's on, but to stay. So I'm thinking about, I'd like to see architecture on the moon, so building things, doing interesting science on the moon, and then using the moon as a platform as a test bed for going out further. So hopefully Mars is the next destination, but also not just human exploration as well, using robotic spacecraft, you know, all the amazing stuff that they do at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, sending rovers to Mars. I want it to be a bit of everything, all these exploratory things to kind of join up, if you like, and to sort of push further. But also politically as well, we're in a new space race, of course, with China. And can we work cooperatively together? I don't know. I look at the current political situation at the moment and it's pretty dire. And so that gives me concern. But then I think about America in the 1960s when Apollo happened. It was pretty bad then. You know, we had the Vietnam War at the same time as Apollo. There were civil rights protests, there was race riots, all kinds of things that we see now. So I hope we don't I hope we don't forget about the good things in our difficult political situation. But it's challenging for sure.
Certainly is. Keeping it going back to a bit more sort of the magic of space and stars. Where have you been on this beautiful planet and looked up and thought, wow, there's something special up there? Is it every time you look up, or sort of is certain times hit you harder than others?
Yeah, certain times it does hit you harder. It's very easy. There is an anesthetic of familiarity, a sedative of ordinariness. And you do take things for granted very easy. Occasionally, I was out actually the other day, I live in the countryside, and I looked up and it was moonless, starless, Bible black, and the stars were incredible. And you're like, wow, I forgot about that. I remember being in Australia once, out in the middle of nowhere, and being absolutely just dazzled by stars. I've been out in the ocean, dazzled by stars. It is a humbling experience.
Completely.
Looking up at the night sky, and it does things to you. You can't help it. You're like, oh my God, we're in space.
This idea of
getting into space, like we're on a spaceship called the Earth.
It's quite a few years ago. I was on a cruise and we were out sort of just in the middle of the ocean, and I was awake at about 2 o'clock in the morning and I needed some air, and I stepped out on the balcony and just saw the moon in complete pitch black. And I'd never felt so alone, but also my legacy at the same time, as it were, to be like, wow, this is us. We are here. Yeah. It was amazing.
The moon is incredible, actually. And I think about maybe I would give the book to Galileo. You know, if we go back to the 1600s, pre-Galileo, pre-telescope, if you like, the moon was seen as a kind of religious, sort of an object of perfection. And then Galileo stuck a couple of lenses together on a tube and brought the moon to us a bit closer. And we could see that it wasn't this object of perfection. It was craggy. It was a world with mountains and ridges and everything else. And that changed everything. It revolutionized. And suddenly it was like, oh, my goodness. There's a world there where maybe there's people on it. Maybe we should try and get there. And so, you know, Galileo's original pictures, drawings of the moon and studies of the moon and of the Jovian moons around Jupiter and all that incredible work that he did in the 1600s, I think it's amazing. That sort of revolutionized everything.
And there are, I say, in the book, there are some fantastic images and pictures and sketches and artwork from lots of Galileo, and over the centuries as well, the moon has been with us the whole time, as it were. You know, it's something that we can't forget about.
Every human who's lived on planet Earth, who's been able to look up and see it, has seen the same moon. And actually, when I look up at the moon, I kind of think about that. I'm like, oh my God, that's the same moon that Galileo would have looked at. And I was lucky enough to, I've met a few Apollo astronauts, but I was very close to one of them, Al Werdner, who's the Apollo 15 command module pilot, who's no longer with us. But I did lots of things with Al, and he became a friend. And so I always kind of salute Al. I'm like, thinking of you.
And that's it. There's only a few people that have been, you know, closer to it than we have, sort of thing. And it's a very special relationship. I say to know someone, to call a friend that's been up into space is a wonderful feeling, I'm sure.
Yeah, and actually, that's the thing I hadn't really thought about Artemis. So I've got to the point where I'm so used to Apollo receding into the distance, this idea of humans. 12 American men walked on the moon, 24, is it, that altogether made that trip. And that's going to end with Artemis. And it'll be, we've got 4 more people with going back to the moon. So we won't be able to say it's been 50 years since we went to the moon.
Which, you know, it seems such a shame, you know, the fact that it just sort of just stopped. We just thought, okay, we've been there. Let's try something else. I said, no, we can still learn more.
Yeah, there's a lot to do. I don't know how many cumulative hours we spent on the moon, but not many, given that it's quite a big planet out there. You know, it's a third the size of the Earth. There's a lot to explore, and also we went to, you know, limited areas of the moon. The idea now is to look at the south pole of the moon, Shackleton Crater, where we know there is water ice there. With water ice, unlocks a whole new world of possibilities in terms of remaining there, having a presence on the lunar surface.
Yeah, it's a lot of potential. So the next, upcoming months are going to be crucial to that. But I'm looking forward to seeing what you think about that and what they do as well. What are you hoping that readers get out of this book when they pick it up and study the pages, Dallas?
Well, that's a good question. A sense of wonder about just how spectacular and rich the history of space exploration is and how wide it is. So that's a sense of fun, a sense of enjoyment, a sense of curiosity about the people that I talk about. I was a kid, I grew up reading encyclopedias and, you know, that because that's what we did. And I always enjoyed reading, you know, I remember having a particular encyclopedia. I always used to skip to the space section.
Yes.
I used to read it over and over and over and over again just because it was so wild. So, yeah, just the pleasure of finding things out, which was a phrase that Richard Feynman used. And there is pleasure in learning things and finding things out.
It is. I got a telescope for my 10th birthday. And I've still got it. It's not as clear as it once was, but it's the same moon that I look through with that old telescope.
Yeah.
That's not changed. And I love that.
It is a constant. And also the thing about the moon as well, it's always that symbol of the unobtainable. You want the moon on a stick or whatever it is. It's, you know.
I'll lasso the moon for you. That's it.
Yeah, it's a symbol of, and so there is, it is a driving force. It's a motivating force to go off and do things and explore and try things out. So the moon is a wonderful companion.
So yeah, the upcoming months are going to be very exciting, and whilst I'm waiting for that, I'll be enjoying your book, sir.
When's the launch date at the moment? 1st of April, I think.
1st of April is coming up, so yeah, one of those days that always makes me a bit worried for sort of news, but yes, apparently so. It's going to be an exciting time. But what does the future look like for you right now, Dallas?
Well, who knows? Who knows what the future holds? Planning new books, doing some more work for the BBC, hopefully. Looking after a dog, doing life things. So, yeah, more of the same.
I hope so, because as I said, I'm looking forward to really, when this book arrives, to just do a deep dive in it and just enjoy it. Now, if I was to enjoy this with the perfect soundtrack, what music should I be listening to, Dallas?
Wow, that is a really good question. I'm obsessed with music. Not just bands, but all kinds of music. What should you listen to? Spotify. What have I been listening to?
That's fun. What inspired you whilst creating the book? Was there a certain album that you heard?
Yeah, music is very important. I was listening to some Popol Vuh. Popol Vuh were a group who did lots of the soundtracks for Werner Herzog's movies in the 1970s. It's pretty fringe stuff. So I listen to all kinds of things. I've been listening to a lot of Beatles again recently, actually. It's funny how. So yeah, whatever. I don't know. Whatever you like. I was listening to the Hans Zimmer Interstellar.
Interstellar.
Again,
that works. That works for it, doesn't it?
There's something quite beautiful about it in its sparsity, which I quite like.
I'm sure you get asked a lot about space exploration in the movies. Which film did it worst?
It depends what you mean by it.
So, well, just sort of talking about space, as it were.
You could look at The Martian and go, oh, well, it was all very accurate and it was all very scientifically correct and historically correct. You know, they went and found Pathfinder and blah, blah. But I think it was a terrible movie.
A lot of potatoes.
It was a terrible movie because it was all just too much exposition. It was just bad filmmaking. But which one got it right? I tell you, a movie which I really love is Close Encounters of the Third Kind. If we're just talking about space movies, I think Close Encounters is an incredible movie for exactly the reasons that The Martians is a terrible movie. Like Close Encounters, there's no exposition in it. Nobody explains anything. You're just on that journey that they're on, and it's really successful and brilliant.
I can remember watching that as a kid and just being amazed by it all.
You know, Alien's a great movie, which is a Ridley Scott film, and the sort of difference between Alien and The Martian is like, it can't be the same person that directed it. So yeah, Close Encounters is a great space movie. My favourite space movie ever is a little short film made by Charles and Ray Eames called Powers of Ten. It's about 10 minutes long, and it examines the scale of the universe. So it starts off on the hand of a picnicker by a lakeside in Chicago, goes all the way out to the edge of the universe, and then goes inside his hand to an atom. You know, and I remember watching that when it came out in 1977, which was the same year that I think Close Encounters came out, and being absolutely blown away. That for me was Powers of Ten. That's my movie choice.
I mean, getting into that, I think there are moments in sort of fiction, in reading and in cinema that grab you. And I think there's a moment at the end of, I think it's the first Men in Black film, where it zooms out and then continues zooming out through the galaxies and the planets.
Yeah.
And
it's just sort well, that comes from Powers of Ten.
Fantastic. See, I'm learning.
They did it actually at the beginning of Contact as well. They did this as well. I don't know if you remember. Contact was a film I really enjoyed. Great I like film. Films about aliens. Contact was a good film. And they started with that. They kind of traced the kind of signal, early signal, as it kind of just went out into the universe. I made a film about Voyager, the Voyager spacecraft. And there's something beautiful about that, that idea of time capsuling, of like messages in bottles, time cap. And so that's an idea that I've always been attracted by.
Yeah, so it's about, they're still happening. Space movies are still occurring.
Yeah.
We were talking earlier about Project Hail Mary is doing very well right now. And there is a Close Encounters reference in that film as well, that is if you there? Do go and see it, you'll enjoy that. But I mean,
go and see it, but am I going to be disappointed? That's my
worry. I don't think so. I don't think so. If you, I mean, The Martian is for some people is like their favourite space film. But what this film is doing now for not only encouraging people to return to the cinema, it's encouraging people to learn about the majesty of space and exploration.
Okay.
So
I'm going to go see it. I'll
good
go
man.
See it. I'll go and see it on an IMAX on a good screen.
That's where I saw it, say, a few days ago. And I've seen some of the huge screens in America. It's on my bucket list to visit the Sphere in Las Vegas and to see some sort of space documentaries on that obnoxious screen that they've got there, just to see what life can be like on that. But
yeah,
but that's it. That is space. It is always going to be exciting and curious for it. So I'm hoping that in years to come you are still doing what you're doing now.
Well,
but
thank
we
you.
Know
I hope
but
so as well.
We know more, and you will help encourage future astronauts as well. So
I hope so.
Where can people find you online and learn more about this book?
Well, you can buy the book anywhere where books are sold, Amazon or Waterstones, anywhere, you know, your independent bookseller would be the place.
Yes.
I'm terrible at social media, but sometimes I'm on Twitter or X, or whatever, and sometimes I'm on Instagram, so I'm there. Come and say hello.
I should do that.
Or stop me in the street.
Stop you in the street. Tell me about this planet. Tell me about this constellation.
And I'd love your listeners to, it's been a journey for me, this book, and I'm really pleased with it. And apart from anything else, it's just a nice thing. It's just as an object, forget what's in it, just as a physical thing, I think it's really beautiful.
I think this it, coffee table books and larger books, ones that we can feel the weight of the words. I love it when that happens with the book. And this one is going to be a real like page turner. And as I said, this is a book that will be in libraries, it will be in schools, it will be talked about in years to come. So That is your legacy now for space exploration and cosmic exploration, as the title says.
That makes me really happy. And I'm glad they called it cosmic. I was dead against the cosmic exploration, but I was wrong. So I'm happy. Actually, that's a good lesson for anyone. Surround yourself with people who will tell you that you're wrong.
Wise words, sir. Wise words. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I know you're a very busy man. I can't wait to see what you get up to next. And thank you for everything you've done.
Thank you. That means a lot. Thank you.